So we're going to be in Genesis 46 as we continue in our study in working through our journey through the Bible. One of the things that we're excited about is just being able to move forward in light of being in the Old Testament. We have on, I believe it's March 20th, a Passover Seder. How many of you guys have ever been to like a Seder, like a full one?
Yeah.
We've been to kind of we've done partial ones, but we're going to do the full one here, which means we're going to get like a full meal instead of like just the little taste things that they did on the tables before. So that's going to be really, really just a great time. Jews for Jesus is going to come out and lead it. So I'm really excited about that. And then we are going to have a great Good Friday service and sunrise service and then two services after that. So it's just going to be a really, really neat time. But we're still right now back in the transition between Canaan land and Egypt. So my question to get you guys thinking about this, kind of this whole process, how do you know you're in the right place? How do you know you're in the right place? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Am I where I need to be? Have you looked at it and you gone, is this really where I need to be right now in my life or in this place? And, you know, in looking at that, one of the things that as I worked out through our verses today and our chapters today is in the process, when you take a look at your life and where you're at, I think that if you're truly going to be following after Christ, the only way that you're going to know that you're in the right place, you're in God's place, is if you take a look at where you're at right now and you look backwards. And you look at what happened to get you to where you're at here. In other words, you look at where you're at now and you see God's hand moving you or moving situations and circumstances to get you to where you're at right now. Because I got to tell you, sometimes in the midst of the journey, you're going, oh no, I am in the wrong place. Because the immediate circumstances don't look that pleasurable. Let's take Joseph for example. Thrown in the cistern in the desert, was he in God's place? Well, we know that looking back, but if he's a young guy at 17 years of age looking up going, I don't think I'm supposed to be here. Or how about in the jail? Was he in God's place? We look back and we say yes, because we can look backwards, but from his perspective, he's looking at bars. I'm not really convinced I'm in the right place. Serving Potiphar's wife and all the different things. How did he know that he was in the right place when he was at the place where he could look back and say, this is why God has brought me to Egypt. This is why I'm here. I am here to provide for my people. But the provision, God's place, was outside of the promised land, and it was preparation. We are all on a journey, and you're going to be on this journey until you get to heaven. Sorry, you don't get to finish until you're there. So it's a process. But along the way, you can stop, and if you're really seeking after Christ and his will and his way, you can stop and look back and say, okay, I'm here because I can see what God has done here, here, and here to get me here. Now, on the other hand, if you say, well, I'm here, and I don't see the hand of God, well, maybe I'm not in God's place. Now I need to go back to where I messed up and start retracing and try to figure out how to be in that right place. We need to be people that are seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Matthew 6:33, then what? All of these things will be added to you. Joseph was a righteous man. God used him mightily, not just for providing for his family, but God used him to honor his covenant promise, which is a big, big deal. Joseph, even at this point in time in his life, doesn't even understand the whole the whole concept. And so we're going to kind of unwrap that tonight as we take a look at Genesis 46. And we start out, we last left Joseph reuniting with the brothers and saying, "Here I am, I'm Joseph." And there was a lot of crying and weeping on necks and all of that kind of stuff. And he says, "Let's go get Dad." So now we're having the reunion where Joseph is being reunited with Jacob after not seeing him for a number of years and coming back into the land. And keep in mind, they're coming out of Canaan land. Why? Why are they coming out? Famine. Big famine, right? So God's providing outside of the land and in this huge reunion. So we're going to pick up here in Genesis chapter 46. And Jay, you want to go ahead and let's pass out. We've got some handouts for you guys. That's going to help you. I'm a real visual person, and so we have some handouts with some maps and some different people or different genealogy. When we get through it, it's going to help us move a little bit faster. And then if you wonder where are these places at, you can look on the maps and you can kind of figure them out. So while those are going out, I'm going to start reading through the narrative here in Genesis 46, the reunion of Joseph with his father Jacob. So in chapter 46, verse 1. So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba, and he offered sacrifices to God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in the vision of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." You guys remember that? That was kind of like, there's a whole Moses thing. Moses, where are you at? Here I am. Abraham, here I am. Seems to be a common way that God calls out. Verse 3, he says, "I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes." And then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives and the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and all the property which they had acquired in the land of Canaan and came to Egypt, and Jacob and all his descendants with him, and his sons and grandsons with him, his daughters and the granddaughters, and all the descendants he brought with him to Egypt. So in this first narrative, we see God coming to Jacob, a.k.a. Israel, as he's coming out. If you remember, Pharaoh sent all of his carts so that the kids and the women and everybody could be carted out, if you will, all the way into Egypt. Now, on your map, it shows the upper route that they would go through. When we see them come out, they're not going to take that same route. It's a very direct route that's coming out, and they're going to go to Beersheba, and it's a place where Jacob or Israel had gone. And he's leaving from this area to go meet with his son and all of them, and Beersheba was the place where God had shown up before. It was a theophany. God had shown up there for Abraham and also with Isaac. They had built altars there, Genesis 21 and also Genesis 26. And he gives to Jacob, a.k.a. Israel, a dream. Calls him out by name. Now, if you were out in the middle of the desert and you heard somebody calling your name in the middle of the night in a dream, you know, "Charlie, Charlie." Charlie go, "What?" And God introduced himself, but what's really important is if you take a look at the narrative here, the promise that God gives, it's huge. It tells us that this is God's intention, this is God's will, God's place. He has a plan. Now, the original promise to Abraham was what? Land, seed, blessing, right? Canaan land was the land. And that was the place that they were going to be blessed in. But here we have God setting up and orchestrating events to actually take them out of the land of blessing into Egypt land, which in typology is always symbolic of the world. It's a place outside of God's blessing. So you kind of get a little bit puzzled. Why would God take me out of the place where I'm supposed to be and put me in a place where I'm not supposed to be? That's because he has some work to do there. He has some work. And so God intentionally is taking Israel out of the land that they were in, into Egypt, because he has some work to do. But notice the promise. He says, "I am God, the God of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I will make you" what? He tells them what he's going to do. there I'm going to make you a great nation. He wasn't going to make him a great nation in Canaan land. He was going to make him a great nation out of Canaan land and then go back in. And notice he says, I will make you a great nation there and I will go with you into Egypt. And what does he say? I will surely bring you out. Here we have a promise. Does God keep his word? All the time. In our timeline? No. Now, if he would have said, look, I'm going to send you there, and you guys are going to be there for 400 years, and your people are going to become slaves, and they're going to have to make bricks with mortars and spit and all of these things, would that be a very pleasant thing? The information is on a need-to-know basis, and guess what? He didn't need to know. He only told them what he needed to know. And what he needed to know was, what? I'm with you, I'm sending you, and I'm going to bring you back out. Oh, and by the way, you're going to die there. Did you catch that part? Your son's going to close your eyes there. So you're not going to make it out. Now, we live in a microwave society where we want everything right here, right now. We want all the answers. But the bigger picture is God is doing a work, and that work is much more than just one individual. It's much farther than that. We are all part of the process of God's will being done. And we want to be in the center of God's will. And here Isaac is coming down in order to establish this nation. And now in your mind, you should start seeing the building blocks of the nation of Israel being put into place, the foundations of that. And so there he meets him there, and he has this dream, and Israel obeys. And I think what's really interesting is this. It says that he took all the livestock and all the kids and all the grandkids. In other words, he packed everything. There was nothing left, what, to draw him back into the land. He packed it all up, and he was fully committed to this calling and this place. And we know that the famine was really, really bad. So they all come out. Verse 8, it says this. Now, these are the names of the sons of Jacob that they come out. Now, verse 8 through 27 is the roll call or the genealogy of all those that came out of the land. You can read it on your own. I'm not going to go through all of those names. You have a genealogy sheet that I gave you. And so we're going to go right to verse 28. How's about that? You guys like that? So all of these sons and grandsons and all of these people come out of the land. And verse 26 actually we'll pick up there. And all the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all, and the sons of Joseph who were born in him were 2. All of the persons in the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. Now, I stopped there because here we have two numbers. We have a 66 and we have a 70. There's a lot of ideas. Why did the author give a 66? Why did he say 70? 70 is a rounded up number. It also counts in Joseph and his. One of the other things that's really interesting is when you take a look at the Jewish government and when they were setting up the government, 70 seems to be the symbolic number that's used for the elders of Israel. If you were to look up Numbers chapter 11, 16, and also 24, 25, when the government was being established for Israel, it was set to 70. Why 70? Because that was the seed of people that came out of the land. Now, is 70 a nation? No. 70 is not even a neighborhood. They're going to need a whole lot more people than that in order to be able to establish this nation. So we see Israel as being in the embryonic state where they're just starting out. And when God works, he works in these small ways and grows something organically. You think about the early church. How many people started the early church in Acts, there in Acts chapter 1? What? About 120, right? How many disciples did Jesus have that really followed after him? 11? And you see the early church, when you go through the whole book of Acts, it started out with small numbers. And now what do we have? We have this huge body of Christ that's reaching out. And God starts out with the small things, and he moves people accordingly. If you ever want an interesting read on the modern version of what was God doing and building his church, Read through the book of Acts and look at how he started out a movement with a small group of people in an embryonic state and how he grew it. Why? Because they were seeking after him. And God was moving people out. In fact, a little side note, why did the whole church leave Jerusalem? Because it was a good idea? Or did persecution come and drove them out? God uses hard times to get us into his place. God uses difficult times to move us. And we don't necessarily understand it, but when we look back upon it, we could say, God, your hand was in it. God, you did this. Thank you. As you move people around for your purpose and for your glory. And so we see this whole group of 70 people come out and establishing this seed in the land of Egypt, of which God was going to make a great, great nation, huge nation. And he was going to start with this group of people that really didn't even know what they were doing, which is kind of cool. Why? Because God gets all the glory. God gets the honor. When you got a bunch of people that don't know what they're doing and just following after God, and God starts moving it, it's an amazing, amazing thing when that happens and that takes place. So we'll pick up in verse 28 then. Roll call is taken, and they're coming back into the land. Now, he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. And they came, you know, we have our own land of Goshen. It's like down towards, gone on the way to Eugene. I actually saw the sign and go, there's land of Goshen. Going out to Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen, and Joseph prepared his chariot, went up to Goshen to meet his father, Israel, as soon as he appeared before him. And he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. And then Israel said to Joseph, now let me die. I have seen your face, that you are still alive. I got to thinking about how funny this greeting would have been. Now, Joseph hasn't seen him in a long time. He gets in his chariot. He comes running up, and he goes, there's Dad. Oh, Dad, I'm so in love with you. And he starts crying on his neck. And Dad, you know, he's really old. He goes, now I can die. Great. Thanks, Dad. I love you, too. But the point was, now I'm satisfied. Now I don't have to worry. Which gives us a little insight about how much he trusted the brothers and what they were saying. Right? Now, because I really don't even trust these, you know, as we say on Wednesday mornings, these bozos in a boat. You know? And he gets there and he says, okay, now I'm relieved. I've seen him with my own eyes, as dim as they are, because he's not really good in seeing right now. And so he is relieved that he sees his son, and he rejoices in that. And he goes on and he says, and Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up tell Pharaoh and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of the livestock, and they have brought their flocks in their herds and all that they have, and it shall come about when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you will say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from your youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may go live in the land of Goshen. Every shepherd in is loathsome to Egypt. Now, in our Western culture, we look at this and we go, okay, Joseph, what are you doing? We're all here, and he goes to them and he says, look it, I work for Pharaoh, I know these people, I know what's going on, tell them you're shepherds, you're herdsmen. Just tell them that. When Pharaoh asks you, this is what you're going to say, right, guys? I mean, again, bozo's in the boat, he's got to make it simple. Tell them you're shepherds and herdsmen. Why? Because the text gives us a clue and tells us that Egyptians hated herdsmen and shepherds. What was that going to enable them to do? Be separate. Not come into the land. Now, Joseph wanted his family there, but he didn't want his family necessarily to become infected by the Egyptian culture. He wanted to protect them. He wanted to keep them in their own land. This land of Goshen, you'll notice on the map, is up in the Delta region. And it was full of good grasses and an area that was away from. It's also called the land of Ramses. And those names are interchangeable. In this, what Joseph was setting for was his own community where the seed of Israelites were going to be able to come together and they were going to be able to grow as a nation in a land that was capable of flourishing, get this, in a time of famine. Is he providing? Absolutely. Joseph didn't get to his position by being a dummy. He knew what needed to take place. And so he wanted his brothers to be able to respond in such a way that they would be able to set up this nation and that there would be sufficiency in that land. He wanted to be assured that Joseph, that his whole family would be self-sufficient and not necessarily that dependent upon the Egyptians. Wanted to be able to take care of them. And I think that's a really good thing. Now, here's a question. Are they in God's place to build a nation? Yeah. The land of Goshen was an uninhabited area. It was unpopulated. It was good for herdsmen, but the Egyptians hadn't come over there yet. They hadn't developed it yet. And so when Pharaoh says, yeah, is there a land we can send them to that they're not going to be around us because they're herdsmen? He says, yeah, they're over there. And you think about what God does. When God sets up a place for you to grow, it's a place where you're going to flourish, where you're going to accomplish what he wants to do in your life. And other people are going to look at it and go, that's kind of a worthless place. But not in God's eyes, because he's working it out. He's working it out according to his will and according to his way. And where God guides, God always what? Provides. It wasn't a place where he was going to take this 70 people, put them out in the middle of the desert, and they were going to die from famine and have to beg. They were going to grow and be able to continue in their culture, at least for a period of time, under blessing, under protection. We pick up in chapter 47. It says, and Joseph went in, told Pharaoh, and said, my father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen. He took, now get this, five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. And then Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? So they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers. And they said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen. Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best land and let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable, and get this, if you know any capable men among them, then put them in charge of my livestock. Joseph brought out his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130, few and unpleasant, but have been the years of my life, nor have they been attained the years of my fathers lived during their years of sojourning. In other words, I haven't lived as long as they have. Jacob blessed Pharaoh, went out from his presence, and Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them possessions in the land of Egypt and the best of the land in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had ordered, and Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food according to their little ones. Did it work? Yes. Now, did you catch how many guys actually went in and saw Pharaoh? Five. I wonder why five? You wonder why five? I mean, he's got a lot more than that, right? Why five? Well, I think one, because he didn't want to overwhelm them. But two, I think he was a little bit nervous that somebody might mess it up. You know? And it doesn't tell us which five. He just sends them in, and he asked him, and he says, yes, we're herdsmen. Now, did you catch the clues, the verbal clues from Pharaoh in the discussion? These five, they answered, yeah, we're herdsmen. And what did he say? Give them the best of the land of Goshen, right? And he goes over and beyond that, and he says, and if there's anybody that you really trust, then put them in charge of my flocks and herds. What does that tell you about how Joseph has lived in Egypt. Did Pharaoh trust Joseph? Implicitly. He blesses. Now keep in mind, these are sojourners coming out of a foreign land, strangers coming into a foreign land, and he basically says, you know what? There's the guest house. Have at it. And you know what? If you want to take out the extra cars, go ahead. Would you do that? Take care of all of these things. He trusted him implicitly. Now, this is a unique Pharaoh, and I think it's solely there because God had worked on Pharaoh's heart to receive the nation of Israel. Will God also work on Pharaoh's heart to remove the nation of Israel? Absolutely. Yeah, Dave. Farmers. Yeah, I mean, you were either a farmer or a herdsman, you know, by trade there in the land of Canaan. But Egypt at this point would be like a metropolitan city. I mean, they were the muckety-muck. And these guys, they were from that Canaan land with, like, all of, yeah, even further out. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be like Tulare. Here you go, Dave. It'd be like Tulare County or something like that, right? Central California, you know. They're going to lie. They don't trust them. Keep in mind when you translate the herdsman motif into the New Testament, the shepherds that announced Jesus' birth, were the shepherds of the New Testament very trustworthy? No, they were nomadic. And nomads would be like homeless, right? Moving from place to place. Herdsmen would have that same reputation. And when we go to Israel here, not too long from now, we're going to see some nomadic areas. It's really kind of funny, side note. When you go to Israel, you see the goat herds, right? And the Bedouin tents. And they have a satellite dish right outside. Right? And, you know, they're driving like Mercedes and all of that stuff. It's really kind of odd. It's really weird. Yeah, you know, and so they're getting their, you know, their TV show, and then they get out, and, you know, and they got their garb, and they go out, and they take their goats out and do whatever they're going to do with their goats, and they come back, and it's really strange. But nomadic, and so they were very nomadic in that area. So, but I love the fact that God had worked in Pharaoh's heart to get the people in and to provide for them, and also to be able to take them out. And Joseph, in this, continues to be used by God to establish and build a nation. Joseph is a nation builder. He's a planter, and he's watering, and he's doing a really good job. And here's where Joseph's wisdom, we get a little side note about how good Joseph is as an administrator. In 13 through 19, we're going to see how it works out. It says, now there was no food in the land because the famine was very severe. And so the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for grain, which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So try to keep track of this. So the first thing he does in order to get all the grain, what does he take up? All the money. And when all the money was all spent in the land of Egypt, in the land of Canaan, and all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food, why should we die in your presence? For our money is gone. And Joseph said, give up your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock, since your money is gone. And so they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys, and he fed them with the food in exchange for their livestock. So what's the second thing that's given up? Livestock, right? So their livestock. Who just came into the land of Goshen to take care of what? Livestock. Is God working? Absolutely. Now, it says, and when that year was ended, and it came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent and the cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left for my lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. So what's the next thing that they're giving up? Their land and themselves. And this is people in Egypt and in Canaan. Verse 20. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. And thus the land became Pharaoh's, and all the people that he removed them to their cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Only the land of the priests did he not buy, for the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore they did not sell their land. And then Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have today brought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. And at the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own for your seed, for the field, and your food, and for those of your household, and food of the little ones." And so they said, notice what they say in verse 25. "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves." And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that the Pharaoh would have the fifth only. The land of the priests did not become Pharaoh. So what do we see here? We see a good administrator, because what does he do? He systematically works through the land, but not in a dictatorial way. He takes what people have, and then he builds up Pharaoh's storehouse. Now, I want you to follow this thought all the way through. Hang on, Barry. You got to follow this thought. Israel comes in the land. They're herdsmen. They're in the land of Goshen. It gets worse. He gets all the money. He gets all the livestock. He gets all the land, and he gets all the people, and he creates tenant farming. In the tenant farming, now Pharaoh is gaining one-fifth of the crop as payment. Four-fifths are going back to the people. Is that too much? No, you should be able to do pretty good off of four-fifths. So he's not mean. And then the people respond, this is a good thing. What is Joseph systematically doing for Pharaoh? Building up his resources, right? He's building up the livestock, he's building up the wealth, he's building up the resources. Why? Because as he's building the bank, that bank is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And when it's time for Israel to leave, guess what they get to take? They get to take the wealth, a lot of the wealth of Egypt. There's going to be a lot more people. And you remember at the end where they're giving up the earrings and the gold and all of these things, and all of this stuff is used to not only take care of the trip, but also to build the temple that's going to, or the tabernacle, excuse me, the tabernacle in that. So is God at work? Absolutely.
He taxed them. Mm-hmm. So it's nobody got the wake-up call. We gave you this. We're just getting it back.
Would it have made any difference?
No.
No. Because Pharaoh was in charge. But they were out of food, right? So they gathered it up, and then they're able to take it back. I mean, and keep in mind, it wasn't a democracy. There is no voting him out. But the reality is that God is prospering the nation of Israel before the nation of Israel becomes a nation. He's preparing everything, working it all together. So the question is Israel in God's place? Yes. Even though it doesn't make sense for them right there. And it's not going to make sense for that generation, nor multiple generations afterwards. It's not until they get back. Now, here's how dense we can be. If you were the nation of Israel now and you were to look back and just read the story and read the Bible, right? Wouldn't you say, okay, God, right? I get it. But we don't go backwards and look at it and watch God's hand and say, God, you have me here because you've been doing a work, and respond to that work. And so we lose sight of that. So when we get frustrated and we say, well, God, are you really in this place? God, are you really at work? Stop. pray. Look back and see what God has been doing to bring you to that spot. Now, are there difficulties along the way? Sure, because we've seen what the boys have done, right? They made some hardship on their own, but in the end, God ultimately is working his will out. And so in that, God is setting up and blessing the nation. Now we're coming to Israel's last days, chapter 48. It says, now it came about after these things that Joseph was told, behold, your father is sick. So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him, and when he was told that Jacob, behold, your son Joseph has come to you, Israel collected his strength and sat up in his bed. And then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. And he said to me, behold, I will make you a fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of people and give you this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Canaan before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. But your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in inheritance. Now as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan and on the journey when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath. That's Bethlehem. Now when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? And Joseph said to his father, these are my sons, whom God has given me here. So he said, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see. And then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. We'll pause there for a minute because I want to take a look at a couple of things. First of all, we see that Jacob is dying, right? He's come to an end of his days, and he's literally on his deathbed. Joseph comes in, and what does he do? Sits up, takes the authoritative position. And he says, look, I want to pass on the covenant blessing that I received to you. This is what God is doing. As a parent, a grandparent, that is our responsibility, to pass on the blessings of God to the next generation and the generation after them. That is our responsibility to do that, to carry it forward. Now, it's no secret that Jacob loved Joseph. He loved him tremendously. And what he wants to do is he brings both of his sons and he says, look it, Manasseh and Ephraim are equal to Reuben and Simeon. Your number one and two are equal to my number one and two. They will receive the same inheritance as if they are my children. Now, on your maps that I gave to you, there was a land allotment, and you're going to see that Manasseh and Ephraim actually get, there is no land of Joseph, is there? There's a land of Manasseh, and there's a land of Ephraim, because they get that double blessing that we're going to talk about in a little bit later. But in that, we see, even though Ephraim and Manasseh continue as sons of Joseph, they receive the land inheritance. If you're taking notes, it's in Joshua chapter 17:17 when it's separated. This land is spread out. We also know that they are given that position of honor. We know that Reuben, the firstborn, loses that birthright, doesn't he? Because he went in and he had a relationship with Bilhah and defiled his father's bed. So is Jacob usurping Reuben's birthright in this? Or is he just saying it's equal? No. It could go either way. We weren't there, so we don't totally know. But what we do know is that they do receive a land inheritance that nobody else did out of Joseph's family. They're elevated to this place of honor, and they're given privilege. We do know, according to Chronicles, and I do want to read this to you, 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 and 2. It says, now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the sons of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to birthright. Though Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a leader, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. So according to Chronicles tells us that this was changed out. So we look at that and we have history. Yeah, we have enough there. But we also see Reuben later getting a blessing from his, well, kind of a blessing, more of a prophecy from his dad, who is, it's not really a nice thing. At any rate, we have Ephraim and Manasseh that are being presented. Now, the text says that Israel's eyes were dim from age so that he could not see. They brought the boys together with them. Now, you got to see the irony in this. Wasn't Jacob the little trickster that went to Isaac and kind of tricked him because dad couldn't see that well? And so now these two boys are coming for a blessing. Keep that in mind, right? Jacob can't see that well, the two boys, and it's time for blessing. Now listen to how this narrative reads out. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well. And then Joseph took them from his knees and bowed with his face to the ground. Then Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them close to him. So look at what he's setting up. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. You see the comedy in this? He gets ready to bless, and so Joseph sets him up according to birth order. This is the way it's supposed to go. And what does Jacob do? Okay, here we go. How did he do that? And he blesses the younger as the firstborn over the older. That's one of the interesting motifs that we find throughout Scripture, where what we think should be the right order, God puts it on its head and flops it and says, no, I'm not going to do it that way. We see that in the Davidic kingdom, right? Was David the oldest, and should he have been picked? No, he was the youngest. He was the guy that was out in the field, right? But God said, that's the guy I want. Because God's ways are not our ways. God's ways are way higher. And so God had established in this that this blessing was going to be this way, and it was just God's standard to convey this blessing. But I also think that Joseph wasn't trying to trick his dad, but the dad knew what he wanted to do. He knew enough where the boys were to be able to give that blessing. And he affirms to them. Now Israel stretched out his hand and he crossed him over, verse 15, and he blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads and may my name live on in them. And the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on Ephraim's head. It displeased him, and he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head. But the father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel shall pronounce blessing, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh, and Israel said to Joseph, behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and bring you, what? Back into the land of your fathers. And I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and my bow. And so we see in the disbursement of the land that Joseph's, instead of one land for Joseph, they get two for that tribe. And in that, Ephraim does become numerically one of the larger tribes that's there, which is an amazing thing to be able to give that prophecy and have it being fulfilled. But the big picture is this. Jacob believed that God was going to bring his nation back into the land. Was he going to see it? Was he going to see the promise fulfilled? No. No. We may not see all of God's promises fulfilled, but does that make God any less faithful? No. God is faithful. And we got to trust in that and believe in that and move forward with it and stand firm on it and not be moved by these things. He continues on. He's getting ready to die, and I think it's interesting to note that Jacob knew that he was in God's place. Joseph is starting to understand that. Now he begins to prophesy concerning his sons. We're going to go through 49 pretty quick, just on these prophecies, not spending a lot of time on them. There are a couple of things we'll highlight. It says, then Jacob summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Now, try to put yourself in each one of the kids' places when dad's talking to you as he's on his deathbed. These are his last words to you. Not all of them are really warm and fuzzy. So he says to Reuben, Reuben, you're my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and prominent in power, uncontrolled as water, and you shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed and then you defiled it and went up to my couch. What did he just do? He just cut Reuben off at the knees. You started out as number one and you are now on the bottom. You just lost it, buddy. Firstborn power and strength, and you lose your position. Why? Because you could not control yourself. Simeon, Levi, their brothers, two swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. And notice what he says, I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. What's significant about that? Did Levites ever own any land? No. They had 45 cities? 45 or 49, something like that. They had 45 or 49 cities, so they didn't get any land inheritance. And if you notice on your map, where is Simeon's land? Simeon's land is in the center of Judah. Now, while that was his border land, did it stay Simeon's land? What happens when something's landlocked? It becomes part of it, gobbled up. So even though Simeon did get a division of the land, it didn't stay his for very long. So the prophecy came forth. Why? Because they couldn't control their temper. And they lost it. So here's number one, number two, and number three. They blew it. Now we come into number four, Judah. Now, this section is the second longest section of the prophecies next to Joseph's. Listen to Judah and put on your messianic ears and filters, because you're going to hear some things you're familiar with. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion who dares rouse him up. Verse 10, pay attention. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine. His teeth are white from milk. Have you heard some of those passages before? Absolutely. If you notice in the conversations coming back into the land, who takes up the leadership as the number one negotiator? Judah. What line was David from in the Davidic kingdom? Judah. What line is the Messiah and Jesus from? Judah. The scepter shall not depart. What is that? That's an eternal kingdom. We have a foal that's tied to the grapevines, a colt. What is that? That's Palm Sunday, where Jesus comes in. The robe washed with blood. If you go to the book of Revelation and you take a look at that whole idea and the washing of the blood, the washing away, it all is symbolic of the messianic prophecy through the line of Judah. And does Judah get what's going on? No. But we do. because that's the place that God has. It's God's place in that. So Judah holds a prominent place in eternal rule and something that we can look forward to, and it is a place of honor. Zebulun. Zebulun shall dwell in the seashore, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall be toward Sidon. The only problem is Zebulun is on land and landlocked. It is not on the coast. So did he mess up? No, not necessarily. One of the things that we do know is that Zebulun was on the major trade route that comes out of and goes through that land. And so it was where there was a lot of trade that was done through that. So there was a lot of trade and a lot of merchandise that was done in that land. We go through to Issachar. Issachar, like Zebulun, is a strong donkey lying down between two sheepfolds. And when he saw that a resting place was good, the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to it and bare burdens and became a slave at forced labor. Issachar was also on a trade route, and he stayed in the middle, and he was just going to be a person that works hard. And if you're looking on the maps, you're going to start seeing these things pop up. The next one, verses 16 to 18, Dan. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heels, so his rider befalls backwards. For the salvation I wait, O Lord. What do we know about Dan? Samson was a Danite. He was one of the judges. And so we see that there was some judgment in it. Although it says that it was a serpent that bites at the heels, he was a real slippery kind of snake guy and just causing a lot of problems. Something else that's interesting about Dan. Dan was told to go into the land, to conquer the land, but what did they find? It was too hard for them. So they decided, a group of them decided to pack up and head north to get away from all the problems in the land. So on your maps, you'll notice all the way in the northern area, the furthest north city is called Dan. Now, again, when we go to Israel, we're going to go to Dan. At Dan is a very large altar that is built. It's all built out of stone that's up there. We're going to go see it. What's interesting is Dan not only wanted to move out of the land because it was too hard, but they intentionally moved so far away that they couldn't worship anymore, so they decided that they were going to establish their own worship, and Dan was the first tribe that brought Baal worship into the land. They blew it. So they got away from central worship, and that made them susceptible to the lies of Satan to bring that into the land. So that's a danger. And again, like I said, we know that Samson was a Danite. We go on, and now we come to Gad. As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he shall raid at their heels. And if you know that, notice that Gad is over there on the eastern side. They didn't enter into the land because they came up to the Jordan. They thought, well, this is good enough. We're going to set up camp here. We're not going to go in the land. We're going to stay out. Did it prove to be troublesome for them? Yeah, because they had people fighting them all the time. Then we come up to Asher. Asher, for his food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. If you notice where Asher is, it's a territory up in the western hills of the Galilee, up by Mount Carmel. And again, when we go to Israel, we'll go to Mount Carmel, and we are going to see nothing but orchards and trees and all this stuff. And actually, Asher got some really good land that's right there. You look up, and you get up on Mount Carmel, and Dan's going, yeah, I remember that. And you look out, and you see the airport, and we see all of the orchards and everything. Fred's going, yeah, I remember that, and everything that's out there. Best place. Asher scored. Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. It was another area in the upper Galilee, in the northern border. And what's interesting about Naphtali is in the region, when they were told to set out their borders, they weren't given an upper limit. They could have gone as far north as they wanted to. There was no limitation on their land, just sides, south, east, and west borders. And we get to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bow. Now, this is for Ephraim and Manasseh. Branches will run over a wall. The archers bitterly attack him, shot at him, and harassed him. And that's talking about his brothers. But his bow remained firm. His arms were agile from the hands of the Mighty One, talking about God of Jacob. From there, the shepherd and the stone of Israel, and from the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven from above, blessings of the deep lies beneath, blessings of the breast of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and the crown and the head of the distinguished among his brothers. And so we see this special blessing that was given to Joseph. It was very long, and it goes to Ephraim and Manasseh, and it was a comfort. Why? Because Joseph got the raw end of the deal growing up, and so he gets this extra blessing. Wow. So then we come to Benjamin. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours, and he was the youngest of the 12. Saul was a Benjamite. The Benjamites were very, very good at fighting. In fact, when you read about them, they were skilled left-handed warriors in that. So you ever heard of the short guy attitude kind of thing? Well, that's the Benjamites. They're the short guy attitude, right? They're the little tough guy that is just like a fire plug that you don't want to mess with. And Saul was one of those guys. Text says all of these 12 were the tribes of Israel. Their father said to them when he blessed them, everyone with the blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged him. He says, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that's in the field of Ephraim, the Hittite, the cave that's in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite. And there they buried Abraham, his wife Sarah, and they buried Isaac and the wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah, and in the field in the cave that purchased. And when Jacob finished charging his sons, it says he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last. In other words, he was sitting on the bed, he was doing the blessing, he rolled his feet up, and he never got out of bed again. And he died. These were the last words and testament of him. We see that whole summary of all the tribes. But the whole point was, put me back in the land. Why? Because I'm going to go back into the land, and so is the nation. We see that Joseph fell. We're gonna skim over 50 really quick. Joseph fell on his father's face, wept. He called the physicians to come and embalm him. For 40 days they mourned. The Egyptians wept for 70 days. Joseph went to Pharaoh, packed up everything with them, packed them up, went back to the land, buried him. Pharaoh said, go bury your father. So verse 7, Joseph went up, buried his father with him and all the servants of Pharaoh in the house. And there they went up, verse 9, both chariots and horsemen, a very great company. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. And there they lamented with a very great sorrow, lamented, and he observed 7 days of mourning. Now notice what verse 11 says. Now when the inhabitants of the land and the Canaanites saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So it was so big that they thought it was Egyptian royalty that was coming back into the land. They buried him in Machpelah, and the sons did this. They lived in that land. Now jump down to verse 15. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong that we've done to him? What were they worried about? Dad's gone. Joseph's going to get even. So they sent a message saying, please forgive us. Dad said you had to forgive us. Notice what Joseph says in verse 19. Do not be afraid for what? I am in God's place. I am in God's place. How does he know he was in the right place? Because he saw everything that God had done. And he knew that he was in the right place. Notice what he says. And as for you, you meant it evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring purpose. This present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And so he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph gets ready to die. In this, Joseph lived 110 years. He saw the third generation of his grandkids come in and goes to his brothers, I'm about to die. And he basically says, take me back to the family grave and bury me there. And now we have the end of the genealogy of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and the building of a nation on the land of Egypt. Amazing. Were they in the right place? Absolutely. Was it a journey to get there? And it's going to be a journey to get them out. We're going to go ahead and just close in prayer and call it a night. Thanks, guys. We pounded out 5 chapters, and that was pretty good. So, but we had to stay with it. So next week, we'll pick up in Exodus. So let's pray. God, we thank you. We thank you for tonight. We thank you for the work that you're doing in our lives. We are in the place that we're at because you are working out your will in us, but not just in us, in the world. We are part of a bigger picture. The neighborhoods we live in, the church we go to, the workplace that we work at, the people that we see in the store are all part of the narrative and the story that you're working out for your glory. Lord, help us to see the place that you have us like Joseph. Help us not to be like the brothers who are only living in the moment, but to really rely on you, God, for everything that's going on, and trust in you for everything that's going on. And when we look back in our life, we can celebrate those times and the places that you've brought us to. Lord, we know that it's tough, and we will go through tribulation, and we will go through trials, but we can be of good cheer because you've overcome all of these things. Greater is he that's in us than he that's in the world. God, you will never leave us, nor will you forsake us. We thank you for that. As we go out this week, may we go out with the confidence of knowing that you're working out your plan for our life. We thank you and we praise you in Jesus' name. And all God's people said, amen. Amen. Praise Jesus.
Thank you for joining us in the study of God's Word. Please join us at Warren Community Fellowship for worship each Sunday morning at 9:15 a.m. or 11 a.m. We're located at 56523 Columbia River Highway in Warren, Oregon, between St. Helens and Scappoose. For more information about Warren Community Fellowship or about WCF Ministries, call us at 503-397-4387.